think so.
24th of June, we're talking to Jim Roop in his home, and we're going to talk about his IBS experience in Vietnam. Here we go. Generally, we start out actually asking questions that are just background questions, hoping that we can get a feel for why you joined the IBS. Yeah, I know, it goes back a long way. We also want to get a little statistical background, whether people come from big families or small, rural families or urban, you know, those kinds of things. So I generally start by asking your birth date.
10-5-41.
And where were you born?
Wisconsin, Platteville.
Platteville, Wisconsin. And did you go to high school in Platteville, Wisconsin?
Yeah.
And did you go to college after that?
No. In Platteville.
In Platteville.
Uh-huh.
Was it called Platteville College?
Now it's called University of Wisconsin-Platteville.
Platteville,
it was,
okay.
It was Wisconsin State College and Institute of Technology.
And what did your family do when you were growing up?
My mom was a teacher and my dad was a salesman.
What did he sell?
Yeah. He used to work in a drugstore, then he had an appliance store, then he used to sell, at the end he was selling lawnmowers and lawn equipment and snow blowers and stuff like that.
Stuff like that. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I had a younger brother and a younger sister. I just have a sister. There were three of us growing up.
Well, you survived the preliminary questions very well. We'll move on to the next level of for 2,000 points. When did you first hear of IBS?
I heard about IBS in February of 66. I was going to school at Boston University, School of Theology.
Well, actually, I'm going to, but that's, so you
Well, anyway.
Yes.
That wasn't really what I wanted to do, but anyway. Mm-hmm. I went over to the placement plate, you know, their placement, student placement, you know, when you apply for jobs. Oh, mm-hmm. Placement office.
That's right.
Good. Career service, whatever. And it just was pure coincidence. I went over there one day, and somebody was recruiting from IBS who happened to be there. So we met the next day, and that was it. I'd never heard of IBS before that.
Never heard it at all. What brought you to Boston?
Oh, this is
long.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we like long stories. That's why we have tape. Yeah.
Okay, I graduated from college with a music major, secondary, went and taught on the Navajo Indian Reservation for 2 years, elementary school. Then I went to school with Then after that, I was accepted into the Peace Corps, and I went to train for Peace Corps of the Philippines in San Jose. I was, quote unquote, deselected at the end of the 8 weeks or whatever, because they didn't think I would adjust to life overseas, and so they said, no, thank you, you can't go. So I didn't know what else to do with myself, so I went to seminary, mm-hmm. and then I found out about IBS.
Why a seminary, though, as opposed to something else?
I don't know. Well, because everybody thought I should be a minister, I guess.
Hmm. And, well, you must have appeared to them to be a nice and intelligent person
yes.
who would settle down very nicely in a town in the United States, but not in the Philippines or
right.
somewhere else. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And so you went to the seminary and you just happened. Why were you going to the placement office?
Oh, because after one semester, I knew I was in the wrong. I didn't want to stay at seminary.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, that was 1966. And they had all the Time magazine said God was dead, so I figured, wrong business.
Yes. Some of us think that's probably why everything's gone haywire ever since. He's insulted, right? But
I think I was tired of. I didn't at that point. I didn't really want to study. I wanted to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And IBS kind of stuff is what I wanted to do.
Well, just to get into what the IBS kind of stuff. Why did you think of the Peace Corps initially?
I don't. Oh God. Well, before that, I wanted to be a short-term missionary for the church, and I didn't make that either.
And which church was that?
Methodist.
Uh-huh.
So I think I grew up in that social activist kind of Methodist tradition.
Had any of your other members of your family done that, though?
No.
But it's something that appealed to you.
Uh-huh. I have no idea.
Well, not everyone graduates college and teaches on a Navajo reservation. But several IVS folk did. Mm-hmm. So, I wonder why.
I guess it's sort of like you have this, I don't know, this call, I think. They used to have, ministers used to have it, but I think other people do too. That they want to go out and somehow do something for other people and help out and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
So you just, yes. So you went into the placement office there, like saying, "Someone give me a test to tell me what I'm really suited for." Or, do you have any jobs available I could take?
It was sort of like that. It was pure coincidence that I found out about IVS, and I don't even remember who the guy was. Mm-hmm. But he came and we talked, and I said, "Oh, this is exactly what I want to do."
Mm-hmm. And it was.
It was. That's amazing. It worked.
Yeah, and it worked. Okay, so he told you should apply for IVS, and you probably wrote him a letter.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and they wrote you a letter back saying,
I don't remember.
I know, that's okay. That's why I'm filling it in for you a little bit.
Is that what happened?
That's kind of what happens.
I'm sure that knowing from what I'd done, that he interviewed me, and then I probably applied, and then in Washington he gave a report and everything. Mm-hmm. Somehow I was accepted.
And you went to, let's see, what year was that?
66.
66?
February.
Right. And then you went to Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, we went to Harper's Ferry.
Were there people in your introductory group that you were to get to know better in Vietnam or elsewhere?
You mean the group that went there? The group that went
to the introductory sessions with. And what kind of team did you think you were going to be part of? I mean, that it was construction, education,
community development. Education.
You knew you were going to do education. And, of course, you had a background in that.
Right. And that was my field. Mm-hmm. ESL was my field. Ah. Mm-hmm. See, when I was on the Navajo Reservation, that's how old I am. Mm-hmm. When I went to the school, when I first went to my classroom, there was a binder with Minnie McGrath, and it was called ESL Pilot Project. Mm-hmm. So, I was part of the pilot, so that's how old I am. But anyway, that's, I think, why I was on the education team. Mm-hmm.
And when you, did you find the ESL training at the IVS gave you in the United States useful? Did you have any?
I don't remember that we did with IVS. When I was with Peace Corps, I'd had training.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that training, plus what I'd already done from experience with the Navajo. Mm-hmm. I don't remember having ESL training with IVS.
They did have a training program for that.
But I think it was the groups after us.
Exactly, that's what I'm probing.
Right, because ours was the last group to do. We did language training at FSI in Arlington. Uh-huh. We were the last group to do everything in the United States. So we were there from February, March, April, I think. We were there 2 months. And we stayed at a hotel by the State Department. Uh-huh. And then we took the State Department and went bus or whatever, went across to the, and we had language training.
Mm-hmm. At the Foreign Service Institute. Foreign Service Institute,
yeah.
Good. That's interesting, we didn't know that. I mean, we haven't interviewed a lot of people from 66, most of them were 67 onward.
And we were the last group, because the next group, they brought them in country to do language training.
So when your training was over, did you go directly to Vietnam? I mean, directly overseas from that point, or was there a...
Yeah.
Any interview? So you flew...
I stopped off in Chicago and said hello and goodbye to everybody and then went. Mm-hmm. So, but it was pretty much straight away.
Yeah.
Actually, what happened? Let's see. I'm trying to remember. I caught up with them in Japan or someplace. And I'm trying to remember whether the agriculture people in our group stopped in the Philippines and went to, Espanos.
Mm-hmm. That's what they were supposed to have done.
And I think our group did that, but I can't. See, I get mixed up which group did what. Anyway.
Well, no, the agricultural group should have gone to Los Baños, but the education group just went straight on.
Then we went straight on.
What was your feeling when, you know, the door opened and you were in Vietnam?
I don't remember. I'm trying to remember back. I don't remember being overly excited or anything. It's just, well, this is where I'm supposed to be and this is what I'm going to do. And so
Let's before we venture onto a Vietnamese soil, there are a couple of other questions that just kind of occurred to me and think about. Back in the, if you were born in 41, just about everybody in the mid 60s was eligible for the draft. You were classified 1A, and that's the question I was asking. So. When did you address your draft board? That is when
I turned 18.
When you turned 18. And how did you, what process did you follow? How did that go?
When I applied to the draft board, I applied as a conscientious objector. I remember I had to write a letter defending why I believed whatever I believed. Mm-hmm. And my minister had to write a letter of support. We sent it in, and that was all I was given there. That's what I'm
saying. You had a CO deferment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I may have had student deferments before.
Mm-hmm. What were your reasons for being a CO?
Because I don't believe in war, and I don't believe I'm a pacifist. Mm-hmm. I think I'm supposed to turn the friends. I'm thinking about that now. But anyway.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's just what I believe. I don't believe in war. I think killing a war is wrong. So I end up doing it.
This is a question that we can explore.
Ended up right in the middle of it.
Yes, that's exactly.
Not what I planned.
And when you went to when you applied to the IVS, you went to the introductory program,
mm-hmm.
and was it clear to you then that IVS was contracted by USAID to supply, let's say, humanitarian aid workers in Laos and Vietnam? Do you recall that?
I think we knew. Yeah, I think we knew. Understood somehow that we were funded through USAID.
Mm-hmm. What was your... go ahead.
Okay. But I always, somehow my mind kept that separate.
Well,
I didn't, when I joined IVS, I didn't join as a conscientious objector, didn't know I could, until I got, I think probably when I was in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I found out that that could be my alternate service, so I wrote back the draft board again, and they said, fine. So my first 2 years I did as alternate service.
Mm-hmm. And were you aware that when you applied to IVS that what IVS was looking for, you know, IVS had programs that actually started in Africa, actually. Mm-hmm. What made you realize that, when did you realize that this was a Laos and Vietnam operation?
Oh, when I talked to the recruiter.
The recruiter said, we're looking for people
to go. He said, you have a choice of going to Laos or Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And I said, and we talked, somehow we got, I don't know how we did this,
mm-hmm.
My decision to go to Vietnam was based on the fact that I had to learn the second language, and Laos and Vietnamese were both tonal languages, but Vietnamese was written in Roman alphabet, so I said, if I have to learn a second language, I don't want to have to learn a second alphabet, so I said I'd go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That was what it was based on, and nothing to do with... See, I suppose I was still sort of ignorant about... Well, no, not 66. Probably knew Vietnam, I didn't know much about Laos. At that time.
And, that's good. That was a good walk down memory lane. That worked out fine. And that does bring us to Vietnam. And when you arrived in Saigon at the airport, and then you went off to the IVS house, which was mm-hmm. about, what, 5 blocks away, 6 blocks away from the airport. Not too far.
Not far.
What do you remember of that first day? Sometimes, you know, your first day at school sometimes sticks in your head, sometimes it doesn't.
Probably the heat. Mm-hmm. I think what I know is heat, humidity, and smells. The reason I say that is I remember it more because on one vacation I remember getting off the plane in Manila. And it just struck me at that time that it smelled different. And it wasn't negative or anything, it's just different. Just the way if we flew to New York, it would smell different than here because it's dry or whatever, humid. I guess that's what I noticed.
By the way, a lot of people notice the smell.
Yeah.
A kind of smell of like a rotting banana plant or something,
yeah,
as opposed to
the smell that,
something else.
It's still in the books, whatever books I still have. Mm-hmm.
And so you went to the IVS office. Was there any assignment procedure? I mean, the IVS house. Was there any assignment procedures that you went through? Like, did you know where you were going to go at that point? Or were you then told where your assignment would be?
I don't think I knew where I was going until after we got there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that for sure.
And where were you?
It probably wouldn't have made any difference because I knew.
Yeah.
I was assigned to Laman,
uh-huh,
which is the next province south of Saigon, between Saigon and Mito.
And between Saigon and, oh, okay. And, well, let's see, but the provincial capital would be Mito?
No.
Then
Laman.
Laman was the provincial capital.
The city is Tangan, the
mm-hmm
province is Loman.
Right.
And they used, sometimes they said we lived in Loman when we lived in Tangan. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, it's the first, the first province south of Saigon going down.
The highway.
Down Highway 1,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
And there was a technical school there as well as a education, was there an educational center there? Oh, actually, to rephrase that question. So you knew you were being signed there,
uh-huh,
and off you went.
Right.
And when you arrived, what was your reaction and your housing, and how did you settle in?
When I first went, I stayed at the USAID compound.
Mm-hmm.
And since I arrived, must have been at this, it was the end of school year. So that meant I couldn't go teach at school because
mm-hmm
there was no school at that
right
time. So I remember at first not knowing what I was supposed to be doing or what I was doing or anything. Nobody told me. So I think I was teaching English to USAID employees there in the compound for a while. Later I heard they almost sent me back because I didn't do anything, but I didn't know what I was supposed to. I did that, and then I went over and taught English, a couple of English classes at the local hospital, because we were in the maternity ward, I remember. And then they sort of introduced me, and so we went up. We had a public school, and then Laman had a normal school,
uh-huh,
which was funded through UN. I don't remember what it's UNICEF or UNESCO. Probably UNICEF. I don't know why I didn't end up there, although that's sort of what I wanted to do. But I remember one of my first experiences was going out there, and I think it was sort of like it was the end of a school year kind of party. I just remember that because myself and the Just Pow person, the USIS person were there, and we had to sing. That was my first experience of learning, knowing that you get to perform when you go to these things. And so we did an awful rendition of Home on the Range. And then somehow I got introduced to the principal of the school, Mr. Swin, who now lives in San Diego, and a group of teachers who were running...
Well, how do you spell his name? It's just for the recording.
X-U-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
And a group of teachers who were running a summer youth program.
Mm-hmm.
The CPS. And so I got connected with them. So actually, every summer I was there, we did that program. Uh-huh. We camp out at the schools, uh-huh. and then they did projects. So the first one we went, I remember the first night, they were having a get together, so they sang and we were talking. I think I said, well, I'm here, I want to help you and everything. And they said, fine. And then I said, but all I have is me. I don't ask me for anything, because I don't have anything. It's just me. And so they said, fine. So then that was the summer. Oh, we did projects. I think that was the summer we built a bicycle shed at the normal school. I know that's the first one we started on, was working out the normal school. Eventually, we built a library at the school. Did some work at a... a shelter for the beggars. You know, the poor people, the beggars, the blind, all those people that hang out at bus stations. We did that. A lot of stuff. But that's how I got started. And then when fall came, I was teaching.
Where did you teach?
At the high school.
Yeah, at the high school. Yeah. Did you still, lived in the...
I lived with them during the summer for a while, and then I moved over and stayed with the USIS person for a while. I don't think IBS was too happy about that, but anyway, that's very good.
Why did you do that?
Wasn't very adventurous. But eventually what happened is...
Do you remember his name? The USIS person? Mm-hmm.
The one thing I remember about that experience is breaking my little toe.
Believe me, I have many dramatic stories about people breaking their little toes.
It's all John Steinbeck's fault. We were having breakfast and the water was coming down, making all racket, so I went back to turn off the pump, and the little toe didn't make it through the door. But anyway, I was having breakfast with John Steinbeck. Anyway,
well, actually, his
son was there.
That's what I was saying.
He was friends with a lot of the side actors. Mm-hmm.
Well, you were actually having breakfast with John Steinbeck. Uh-huh. I just want to clarify for the tape.
Yes, John Steinbeck and his wife and I were having breakfast.
Exactly.
And I was just being a gentleman and I broke my toe. But anyway. Uh-huh.
Why was Steinbeck there? He was a journalist, so...
Right. Yeah. I think he'd come and he was... USIS was taking him around the country to visit and talk to people. I think he was going to write about it, but I think he really came to see his son, but... Mm-hmm. And then after that, then there was a Korean IBSer, Yong Kim. I think he lives up in Central California in the mountains somewhere. Hmm. But he came, and he was doing rural development.
Myung Kim?
Myung. M-Y-O-N-G.
K-I-M.
K-I-M is family name. Mm-hmm. So after he came, then we found a house and we went and lived with the family. And I lived with them for the next 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know where he's upset. He's in upstate, up in the mountains somewhere in California. Mm-hmm. And he married an IBSer too. I can't remember her name.
One of our interests is getting in touch with as many Vietnamese who work with IBSers as possible.
But he was Korean.
And he was, well, yes. But still, he's a third country, so to speak.
Yeah.
In fact, he is a third country, that's what you call it. And that would be interesting to talk to him, just so we have a variety of different people. So it'll be worthwhile.
He's in California, but I don't know where. Mm-hmm. Last I heard.
That's okay. That's my job, unfortunately. Okay. But if you think of something, Placerville, that's it. Something like that. Okay. Please let me know. Yeah.
It's one of those kind of places. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's up in the...
There are about five IVSers who live between, like, Merced, you know, Fresno, Merced, mm-hmm. Stockton, Davis, Coarse Gold, Douglas Flats, were two cities I've never heard of, and, mm-hmm. and I'm from California. And I'll be visiting all of them, so I'll keep an eye out. They may know who he is.
Yeah. And the alumni stuff, I haven't heard. It might help. I mean, IVS might know who he married, because she was an IVSer. She was a bug person, entomologist.
Mm-hmm.
She went over there to work on bugs.
Mm-hmm. No, it's important.
Yeah, it was.
Yes.
It was very important.
Mm-hmm. And so he said, so we have Danger, the toe, Romance, John Steinbeck, I just need to pick up the thread. You were, for a while, you lived with the IVSer, yeah. And then we just bound.
You know, Kim and I, we moved in with a Vietnamese family, mm-hmm. and I stayed with them.
Yeah. So, we'll kind of snuggle it up right over here. I was listening to the tape spin, and that was louder than your voice.
Oh, okay.
But, why don't we, so you moved in, let's just pick up where you were living with the family.
Yeah. In fact, we still write. When we went back to Vietnam 3 summers ago, we went to visit them, so we're still in contact together. But they had a big house, and so we used to stay. And then when, somewhere along the line, we picked up another teacher, Dolores Honig, who's in the Washington, D.C. area. And so the three of us stayed there. And then the next school year, I started teaching, and they gave me all the first-year students.
All the first-year students?
I had four English. Yeah, we had four English classes. So I taught four classes to the sixth graders. Yeah, because high school there, they have like junior high, senior high, but it's all together. So I taught sixth graders. And 7th grade.
And what were your relations with the students like? What were they like?
Just like, I don't know. We had good teacher-student kind of relationship with them. With some of them. It's kind of hard when you have, as I recall, every class had 60-some students. So I had 63 students in four classes, so that was... whatever, 4 times 60, whatever. That's 200.
Yes.
Okay. So I don't recall knowing them all very well. I knew the typical teachers, the ones who sat in the front who were the good students.
Right.
The ones who sat in the back who were terrible students, I knew. And the ones in between, probably I didn't know too well.
What were the backgrounds of those students? Were they,
okay, they probably all had a... their background would be varied, but all of them had to have passed an exam to get into school. Mm-hmm. And as I recall, the year I helped with the exam, we had 4 students for every slot that we had room for. So they were the better students. Mm-hmm. And most of them were probably from at least middle class or above. But not all of them. There were a few kids who came in, but because, education is important, and in spite of everything else that happened during the war, the government did try to keep schools open, and I think they, and actually built classrooms and got the American government to help them too, but because I remember one. I'm rambling here, but anyway.
No, that's why we're here.
Right? Okay.
The more rambling, the better, yes.
I do remember that there were a couple times when I went to a school, elementary school, and it was built by Navy SEALs and people like that who did that on the extra time. So I always felt that in spite of it all, the one thing the Vietnamese did and the Americans helped them do was try to keep education going. And I think the communists probably did too. They just did it differently than, from what I know now. But
In educating them, what did you think the value was of them learning English at the time?
At the time. That's a good question, because I'm not sure I know the answer. I think part of it is that when I went as a, it's going to sound weird, English is a second language. But now that I look back, I was teaching English as a foreign language. Because they only needed to know English as a subject, like we need to know Spanish or something. Sometimes looking back on what I know and what I've studied since, I'm not sure that we were teaching it. You know, we taught audio, lingual, listen, repeat. I'm not always sure that that's what we should have been doing. But anyway, the time I didn't know, and that was what we were doing anyway.
Right, but there was a requirement in the high schools in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, you either had to have French or English. And the way things were going, the number of French classes were getting fewer and fewer French classes, and the number of English classes were increasing. And probably
June 24th, talking about curricula in Vietnam. Okay.
And probably it wasn't so much important that we were teaching English so kids could all be great English speakers, but that we were working with the other teachers in curriculum and methods and helping them. And probably it was, now look back, probably more cultural things we were doing than actual language, because, you can't separate culture and language, but somewhere in the back of my head, I always thought, well, I'm going to be this antidote or this opposite of all those GI kind of, so that people knew that there were other people besides soldiers, other than Americans, because when I got, 66, there weren't very many Americans where I lived. There were just advisors, USAID, military, USIS, CIA, and the bunkers. Anyway, the buildup came in, 67? It had to be 67.
Well, the buildup for the Delta did begin later than elsewhere.
Right.
And then
because
it was
we didn't have any soldiers stationed there until after I was there for about a year. And then they were kept on that, sort of like at the edge of town. But I do remember when they first came, this young kid about 18 just was amazed that I was wandering around. But he was petrified. They must have told him all kinds of terrible things that had happened to him. But
What do you recall the conversation?
He was patrolling the village, he said. And that was when they first came. Then after that, they drew him back. They never even had to do that. But he was asking me, he said, aren't you worried? I said, no, I live. He said, but don't you know they put ice, or they put glass, grind up glass in your Coke? And I said, no, those kinds of things that he'd heard. And so, no, I said, no. But, so that, they were there, I'm trying to, 68 type of things. I think they, when I left in 70, they had started a downslide already, I think, and the numbers.
Yes.
But most of the regular soldiers and stuff were on the edge of town, and we saw a lot more of them after they came, but we didn't see that much. Uh-huh. In Lamont, I don't think.
And when you were engaged in these projects and teaching at the school, can you kind of think of what a typical day was like in those days? You know, it's a way of thinking like what your room looked like, you know, what your bed looked like. Some people suddenly remember that they put sandbags around their bed. You know, that kind of different area, of course. But,
well, we did that in 16.
Uh-huh. We'll get to that.
We'll get to that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
David, okay. Basically, I had a room in the house. They had they lived in a compound. In front of us, the main highway was in front of us. And then there were buildings between us and highway. So you had to go down a lane to get to our house. So we were back away from the main road. And then to the left of us was kind of marshy and swampy. And then on the other side of that was a river.
Uh-huh.
A big river, which probably is one of the tributaries of the Mekong. And then there was a bridge right there. So that's where I lived, and I stayed in the room. So I get up in the morning, get ready, get dressed, have breakfast, and then go to school. I either went by, first I had a bicycle, and then I rode on public bus, and then eventually I got a motor scooter from IVS. And so I just went down, actually all I had to do was go up the highway and go down the highway because the school was on the other side of town,
uh-huh.
down there. And then I taught. Big deal. No. But see, we did half days,
uh-huh.
as I recall, because this, in order to accommodate all the students, we didn't have enough buildings. So one year I taught, because I taught all the same level, one year I taught only mornings. The first year I taught mornings, and then the second year I taught afternoon. So we went, 6:30 to 12:30? And afternoon was 1 to 6. I think it was 7:30. I don't know. And a few times I appreciated getting up in the morning because it was cool. So that's what they did. Taught in the morning. Seems to me the first year I taught, I had classes of my own. Then later on I did some team teaching so that we could work together. I remember going to teacher meetings. By third year, I understood what was going on, usually. But I was treated pretty much like a regular faculty person. I was expected to do crazy, expected to go to meetings, all that stuff. Afternoons, I siesta. Wonderful institution. And then if I remember, we probably had extra classes and did things in the afternoon for students who wanted to study English more.
Uh-huh. What did you do in the evenings?
That's a good question. What did we do in the evenings? Sometimes we watched television. The Kai Lung was very popular. We also had Armed Forces television. So you could watch combat on TV or go upstairs and sit on the roof and watch.
Combat. Yeah. It is amazing that combat was one of the more popular programs in Vietnam.
Uh-huh. It was. It was really weird.
Do you remember any other television shows you watched? I think, was it Gunsmoke or Bonanza? Can't remember.
I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I just remember combat because
mm-hmm. of the irony.
It wasn't really my cup of tea, but I mean,
mm-hmm.
and I remember the Kai Lung because that was always on a Friday night in the house. That was the one night that everybody stopped everything and we had the whole neighborhood in watching. Kai Lung. Kai Lung is C-A-I dash L-U-O-N-G. The best way to describe it is it's a musical, like a musical play. It's based on the old Chinese opera, but it's a more modern version that took place, that became popular around the 1920s. The old version, the Hak Boy, which is H-A-T-B-O-I, is more traditional, where they sound more like the Chinese operas. But this is more, I remember one of them, they were all dressed like cowboys and Indians, but anyway, very, very popular. And so on Friday night, when that was on television, that just, everybody was there watching it. Sometimes when the Kailun troupe, they would travel around, when they came into town, we'd go watch it at the theater, which was nearby. I remember seeing a hot boy one time on the street. I don't know why. It must be some festival or something. Anyway.
Yeah. Do you remember any contacts with any IVS officials or other IVSers during that time? Because there should have been a lot of IVSers in town. Oh, spell the name of the town.
Loma, L-O-N-G-A-N, or the city is T-A-N-A-N. Well, we had three of us stationed there. So, but since we were close to Saigon, sometimes got visitors. Not very often, but Don Luce would come by. Gene Stolfus.
Right. S-T-O-L-F-U-S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then after Don left, then Dan Whitfield would come too. Eventually, when we divided up into areas, our area leader was Herb Roos. So Herb would come down.
And that's Herb?
R-U-H-S.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. R-U-H-S. Okay.
He used to live in Riverside. Now he's over in, living on the, he's not there now.
He used to live in Riverside, but now he's living
in Maine.
Oh, in Maine, yes. He's on, I'm pretty sure we're talking about. Or at least he's on the list.
Yeah, he was that bunch. Yeah. I call him the John Steinbeck Jr. bunch. There was a group of them. Anyway.
Why did you call them the John Steinbeck?
Well, they hung out with him.
Are they what?
They hung out together.
With John Steinbeck or John Steinbeck Jr.?
Yeah, John Jr.
Jr., yeah.
Inside that, from what I hear. I don't know. I didn't, for somebody who lived close to Saigon, I didn't get in very often. Mm-hmm. And eventually what happened is when I went into Saigon, I didn't go to the IVS house. I'd go stay with teacher friends. Because the way it worked, the way the system works in Vietnam, when you go through your normal school, or in the case of high school teachers, they had to go to the four-year teacher school. At the end, the better your grade was, the closer to Saigon. Theoretically, our teachers were better closer. But a lot of them would come down and teach full days like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then go back to Saigon for the rest of the week. Mm-hmm. So they'd just come down and stay part-time. So a lot of the teachers that I knew, or the ones that I became friends with, lived in Saigon. So when I go up to Saigon, I'd go see them. I guess didn't even know I was in town. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'd go off, but usually not. Then there was another group of teachers. One of the things I remember about Laman was the fact that as teachers we were friends too. We had a group that we took turns. Like 1 month we went to one person's house and ate, and then we took turns. Because later when I went up to Hue with the Fulbright, it was completely different. Didn't have that kind of interaction or that friendliness that you did. And I don't know, people always say that the Southerners were more friendly, but my own experience was that's true, but that was just my experience. Uh-huh. What else?
Well, Do you remember? Is there?
We also had okay. Mm-hmm. When you mentioned Dennis, the one who did the mushrooms,
mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure his group did part of their in-country training at our house. I swear he's the one that went. He'd go back. We had a big fish pond in the back,
Mm-hmm.
That he went swimming in the fish pond and he ate fish. But because when you said mushrooms, the reason I think that is when they were one of the things they did when they came down was learn how to grow mushrooms. So I think he was in that group that came and trained for a little while with us. Myung Kim was in that group too.
Myung Kim was with IVS, but was a Korean volunteer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he did rural development.
And
I didn't have much contact with other IVSers. I remember we did a workshop. The education team, Billy Lee Langley, started. She and I had the contact. We still do. But
where does she live now?
She's in Lakewood.
I see. Lily, sorry?
Billy Lee.
Oh, Billy Lee. Oh, yes. But she's not Langley anymore.
Langley.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, I'm waiting for her to call me back, okay. I think.
I just talked to her yesterday.
Okay. Oh, wait a second. Billy?
B-I-L-L-I-E.
I-E, right.
Lee.
Langley. L-A-N-G-E-Y.
G-E-Y.
G-E.
Langley. L-A-N-G-L-E-Y.
That's right. Yeah. In Lakewood.
And she's in Lakewood, yeah. Okay. In fact, we just talked yesterday. She's going back to Vietnam in August.
Mm-hmm.
But the one time I remember contact was we went to Vung Tau and we had this big trainings. We did training on with ESL. Because I was there, the other ESL teachers were there. I think Mr. Swin, our teacher Swin, went, my principal, and other teachers. But
yeah. That,
and then the other time was when they took, when was Quang Tri? 1960, two other times. One time I went to Dalat with, probably about 68, they started a youth leadership team or something. Mm-hmm. They weren't education, but they did like I did, working in the summer with the youth program. And then we had the in-country IVS. What's called VBS? Right. That's sort of a local branch, and we had a workshop up at the lot once. I went to that, and then one time, one summer, we had this big thing where all the youth groups went up to Quang Tri and they helped rebuild the city. So it was after
Easter of 1970.
Is that when it was?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 72, actually, was when Quang Tri was.
Yeah. It must have been after. Maybe it was after the Tet.
Maybe after Tet. 16. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Maybe it was the next year because I remember our kids went up. I didn't get to go up for some reason, but I went to Saigon with them, and then they went up. And then afterwards, I heard that our kids were the best workers up there. The rest were just went up for fun and singing, and ours really worked. But anyway.
Since the war is beginning to intrude on our narrative, obviously you're the province that you're in, mm-hmm. is one of the most famous provinces of the war, actually.
Really?
It's one of the few that actually have a complete study
done.
Jeffrey Race.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you've read it? Have you read it?
I haven't read it because I don't read war very well.
Well, it's not war, really. It's mostly just about VC political organization in the province and mm-hmm. and what their methods were. Salubrious and unsalubrious, but you lived in it. You know, I wonder. But,
totally oblivious.
Yes,
no.
Yeah. Well, in town.
Well, it's interesting what happened in '68.
Well, let's start thinking about prior to '68.
Prior to
'68. We'll pick it up after.
I don't know. Yeah. Prior to '68.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just sort of like it was something that was happening around us.
Mm-hmm. You could go up on the roof and watch it, some of you can?
You could. And somehow you always, they said, you know, if it's after they put the battalion right by the bridge and then it shoot out, and you just learn to sleep through it, and then it was coming. They said if it ever comes in, you would wake up, and I think we got that point, 68. But the only thing I remember, the only problem was I was pretty much limited to working in town. Uh-huh. I didn't go out to, you know, the districts, not very often, once in a great while. And I'm trying to remember, Myung Kim was the same. He did work, but it was usually close to town.
Now, of course, the war was out in the countryside there, but surely large numbers of people in town were directly involved.
That's what we think. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was talking about. In 68, nothing really happened in Lam An. Mm-hmm. Or when the whole business started, actually what happened is they made us go over to the USAID compound and sleep at night because it was in the center of town. I just remember listening to the radio. They kept losing howitzers. Anyway, so we went there maybe 4 or 5 nights, every night. In the meantime, they were in the process of building a new soccer field at that time, which they never finished because everybody went out and filled out sandbags. So we had this little bunker built between we had the main house and the second. But anyway, finally they decided it was okay for us to stay at home. And that's when a battalion of North Vietnamese were going to try to blow up the bridge right by our house. Mm-hmm. So we spent that night in the bunker, listening to things going on. Our neighbors next door were with us. They lived in a wood house. Next day they went back and a bullet had gone through 3 walls and right across their bed. That's my war story. But anyway.
Did they blow up the bridge, by the way?
No. Ours was never. Yeah.
You said North Vietnamese.
That's what they, anyway, this is the story afterwards. It was what they said. Yeah. It was a battalion of North Vietnamese.
A battalion of North Vietnamese as opposed to Viet Cong.
Right. Uh-huh. Then the other theory was that the reason nothing happened in Lam An is because that's where families of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese officials lived. And so it was their own people living in town, therefore they never attacked the city. That was the theory.
Another theory of events at the time was that nothing really happened because...
It wasn't worth anything? I don't know.
No, that My Tha and Saigon were the actual areas of the... All the focus was on those two places,
right.
And everyone was moving across the province.
That's probably
true.
That,
rather than...
Sure.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, we'll find out.
We were pretty much isolated in the town. Mm-hmm. I just remember that we had the curfew, and we couldn't eat, and all we had to eat was banhtet, that's banh-tet, that's cakes for New Year. Mm-hmm. And then we could start getting refugees, so that we didn't start school. I don't even know if we went back to school that year, because our schools became refugee centers. Anyway, 2 months after that, I got infectious hepatitis, and I had to leave anyway, so I don't know the end of that school
exactly
year.
Well, let's go back a little bit. That's 68.
Yeah.
So let's go back a little bit back to 67. You'd been there for a year. I presume that one day Don Luce showed up on your doorstep and wanted to talk to you about a letter he was writing to Lyndon Johnson.
Was that in 67?
I think it was 67. It was before the Tet Offensive. And Dan Whitfield took over for Don.
Right.
So it could have been in, well, it
I don't know the time.
Yeah, I don't think
it was
66.
Yes, Don Luce did come personally to show me the letter.
Did you know he was coming? Did he get in touch with you and let you know he'd like to talk to you about it?
No.
He just showed up.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think we had any way of, we didn't have any communication.
Right.
I mean, people just showed up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, he came by and showed me the letter, asked me to sign it. I read it and I signed it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was going to be published, but that's beside the point.
Well, it was a letter to the President of the United States, yeah. So, you know, you just take
it. Yeah. Well, there was no reason for me not to sign it, because, uh-huh. Of course, it said what I believe.
Well,
I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to put things together. Uh-huh. Is 67 the year of Kent State?
No, that was 70. That's okay. By the way, the more spontaneous your memories are, the better they are. So it doesn't matter if you get the dates confused. We'll always straighten the dates
out. The one thing I remember about 1970 was it was sort of like listening to the news and not knowing whether they were talking about Vietnam or the United States, because there was a lot of upheaval going on in more in the cities and the universities in Vietnam at the same time.
There was a lot of campus unrest in Vietnam then.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back which is why so many of them ended up on the Kong Song Island, so Don could go out and visit them.
Right.
You know, the line was the Congressional Investigating Committee wanted to speak to some student leaders, and a guest at Don's house said, "But they're all in tiger cages," and that's how that that's how that got started. Yeah, it's
that,
interesting.
That's
I was
made
lucky
Don
enough.
The most popular person in the world.
Yes, exactly, and I'm very happy to say that by a sheer series of coincidences, I'm the person who wrote the encyclopedia entry on Kong Song Island on Pueblo Condor.
Oh, really?
So it was great because I knew Don, and I also knew some Pentagon people who knew about it or went, actually were there when Don went there. So it was an interesting.
But when did he?
Well, that was after he was with IBS, and he was there working in other projects.
That's when he came back, isn't
mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
So
he came down and we signed it, mm-hmm. and then it got published, and then he came back again and said, "You're in big trouble." We were. I didn't. See, I just do these things and I don't pay attention.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let them worry about, you know. Mm-hmm. I was doing my own thing. I would worry. But I, afterward, they came down. It was probably Dan Whitfield who came down and talked to us later
mm-hmm.
about the fact that we'd signed the letter and that the Vietnamese wanted us gone.
Mm-hmm.
Both governments were a little upset with us. And
mm-hmm.
that I think we came close to getting kicked out of the country, if
mm-hmm.
I remember. But see, I would.
What did you think about that?
What, being kicked out of the country?
Yeah, I mean, if Whitfield came and said, you know, this kind of thing almost is going to lead to closing the program, do you remember what your reaction was?
Well, I'd probably been very upset.
Because.
Well, that we'd have to leave, that they would. And I wouldn't be upset that I'd signed a letter or anything.
No. I meant, why would you upset that you'd have to leave?
Well, I didn't think I was ready to leave, and I didn't think, you know, I want to probably, if I want to sign a letter, you can't do anything.
Uh-huh.
That's my right as an
American citizen.
It doesn't matter that I'm in this completely different country. It doesn't believe that you have any rights anyway, but that's probably what would have upset me.
Uh-huh. But you also valued the work that you were doing?
Uh-huh. I think what I valued was working with teachers and working with the kids in the summer and doing youth work and going to Vung Tao with youth camps and building and singing and
building.
Building and singing.
And, okay, well, I guess we can move on to the Tet Offensive. This was the, you know, the great offensive that was. Everyone now claims that they anticipated this is fine.
Well,
no one was really surprised.
Everybody in Hawaii believes it. They
yes.
say that. Never mind. People in Hawaii believe everything.
Yes. Well, maybe they should. Mm-hmm. Yes, but the idea was that what was it? What were the first hours of Tet like in town? I mean, there wasn't any assault on the town itself.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, we started hearing rumors and stories, and I'm trying to remember. Because it started at midnight,
uh-huh.
right, when everybody was shooting firecrackers and everything.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. Nothing happened where we were.
But then they wanted you to, you were told
then the
that,
next day, uh-huh. I'm trying to figure it out. The next day we heard, then we started hearing things either on the radio, probably television. The one thing I remember all the way through that was Whenever they were doing announcements or anything on Vietnamese television, it played The Sound of Silence. That song is, you know, whenever I hear it, that's all I think of. Because every time there was a news broadcast or anything about what was going on, they played that song. I thought,
on Armed Forces or radio?
No, on the Vietnamese
channel. On the Vietnamese channel?
Huh. Like, why are they playing The Songs of Silence? Sounds of Silence. It just
You know, Hello Darkness, my old friend. In English or in...
No, it was just...
Just the music.
Instrumental.
Uh-huh.
But it was... I thought it was kind of ironic. But anyway. appealed to my sense of...
Yes, of the bizarre.
The absurd. Yeah.
Uh-huh, and the absurd. And...
I think Vietnam did that a lot.
Well, I think it did for everyone.
Maybe that's why I liked it so well. Uh-huh. It's absurd. But anyway. We knew. How did we know? Wait, I know. Got back up here. Dolores and I were there.
Dolores
Honing, the other teacher. We were here. Myung was in Dalat. Uh-huh. Okay, so when he came back, he told us his stories. He actually had. They actually gave him weapons. Uh-huh. Let's see what happened. Everything gets confused about when I heard about it. So we knew. I think our reaction was we were always hearing about this place being attacked or that place being attacked, and then thinking, well, we know so-and-so, or we know so-and-so. What's happened with, you know, what's happened? And we didn't know what was happening with Neil. That was the same time David was killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that just added to it. And Is David killed right before?
Just before, in the week before.
Right, because see, he was in my group. Mm-hmm. And Don came down to tell us.
That David had been killed?
Mm-hmm.
Was it? Do you remember if that was before Ted?
It has to
be. Oh, it was before Ted. Oh, I remember. No, I remember everyone knowing they were going to hold a memorial service in Saigon, but the Ted offensive broke out right at the same time.
I think it was Don, or it may have been her, but somebody from IVS came down to... Ruth, our team leader. Somebody from IVS came to tell us personally about David. We didn't hear that from the radio.
Do you remember what they told you? As opposed to what you learned later?
Yeah, I'm trying. Yeah, I'm going to get things mixed up.
Get them mixed up then. Go ahead. I mean, as close as we can get.
I think at that time, they said he'd been killed. And I think when they first said they didn't know for sure... I think at first they didn't. But I think they were suspicious all along. And I don't think we've ever cleared up for sure who did it, which side did it, or why. Because then right after that, during the Tet, it must have been before that, because during Tet Offensive is when there was an article like in Time and Newsweek, I remember reading about. Anyway.
Did you know David well at all?
As well as I was sort of a loner. As well as I knew everybody in that group. We had room.